All right. Did you enjoy your lunch break? Good. All right, so do you usually have a prayer you do in English as like a refuge and bodhicitta prayer?
Oh, yes, we have it.
Yes, should we do that, please, as a just to set the motivation and then to set the mind and be focused on the meaning of the words? So just first take refuge and then generate bodhicitta.
It's on the bottom of the first base sheet. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings.
All right. There are more prayers, but those you can do at home or at a different time. So let's go into the topic. Are we complete? Do we need to wait for anyone, or we can? No. Okay, we can just continue. Okay, great. So, well, first of all, I apologize. I couldn't take everyone's questions, and I was a little long-winded, so I tried to keep it a little shorter so I make sure everyone's questions will be addressed next time. And, of course, I'll take again questions at some point. But to go more into the debate itself, I hope I gave you some sense of where it fits in, that this is just a tool, it's something one needs to let go of when the time is there. Take it to a deeper level or different levels. All that is important. It's also important to keep the mind calm and relaxed and to do, you know, as much as we can actually do. I'll talk more about, I guess, about also how to generate one's own practice, which will be the talk on Monday, so I won't really address this today. But I'd like to introduce the debate itself a little bit. So this is what you're here for. So to just tell you how the structure works, this idea of syllogisms, and it's not as complicated as it sounds, and it's like anything, you do it once, it seems very complicated, the next time a little less so, the next time a little less so, and at some point it becomes second nature. And then, of course, having explained those, also addressing Venerable's question about how we can actually use our own, you know, on our own, how can we use this tool, or maybe this idea of reasoning, maybe not exactly the vocabulary, but the type of reasoning to read a book, when we read a book, for example, when we study the Dharma. Okay. Now, to say a little bit more about the structure of debate, the syllogism, of course, very important, but also another point I'd like to raise, or another explanation I like to give. When debating with someone, there is a way in which you say there's three parts to a debate. There's refuting someone's wrong view, then establishing the correct view, and eliminate the inconsistencies. Eliminate inconsistencies, or eliminate the misperception that people have about the incorrect view. That's kind of the goal. So it's often structured, and I gave you already that example of someone saying something that is considered incorrect, and it could just be made up. It could be just a wrong view that someone could have, right? So in the scriptures, the debate manuals, they're described that way. Someone says so-and-so. So you're trying to refute that. Then you establish what is the correct kind of definition, for example, of something, and then you try to eliminate whatever wrong view someone has. So many of the texts are structured in that way. But the basic thing that you have is this syllogism. So use this. And you can say anything with this. But it's weird. It's even weird to Tibetans because they don't speak like that. So when they hear it on the debate ground, they don't necessarily understand because they don't talk like that. But when you debate with someone, you never kind of say, you are wrong because of so-and-so. You try to point out the absurdity of someone's wrong view. They say that is much more effective. If you point out the absurdity of someone's wrong view, then they can see what all the the implications are. If I say something is impermanent, whereas actually it is impermanent, I mean, so many absurdities result from that. If it was really that way, if this cup was permanent, then this cup could not be filled. This cup could not be moved, and this cup could not be broken. You know, so many absurdities that would follow from that. So instead of saying to someone, well, this cup is impermanent because of such and such, you kind of point out the absurdity if it was really permanent, right? But you say it in a way which is basically saying, this cup is such and such, because, right? This cup, so you have always a subject. There are three parts to what is called a syllogism, which is just borrowing a word from Western philosophy. So a syllogism, which interestingly it existed. I mean, Socrates is immortal because he's a man, right? The typical philosophical kind of syllogism. Here's quite similar, right? You say such and such, there's a subject. The subject, the cup, right? It changes moment by moment. That's B. A is B. So the subject, the cup, it changes moment by moment, or the way it's actually formulated, it says it follows. This is only, it's actually the same as saying, you know, A is B, or A, it follows that it's B. You use the word follows, yeah? In Tibetan, it's tal, which basically just, you want to point out the absurdity, to get across this idea, oh, it follows from whatever you assert, it follows that so-and-so is so-and-so. But sometimes you don't use it that way. You just make a statement, A is B because it's C. But you use that language. The subject A, it follows such and such, right? The subject myself, it follows I'm a woman. So basically I'm just saying I am a woman, right? The subject myself, I'm a woman. So it's just how the word, if you translated it literally, but I don't have to translate it literally. I could just say the subject, that's the first, that's A, the subject, because there's always something you're investigating, right? There's always a subject, there's always a thing, the self, or the cup, or the mind, yeah? So some basis. So that's the subject, the cup. And then there's a predicate. There's something about that object, it being permanent or not, impermanent or not, it having a color, it having a shape. So this is, we basically, when we start off debating, we don't go right away into impermanence and all these difficult points. We do very quickly define it, but there's not much explanation, right? We basically start off with colors and shapes. We take colors and shapes. There are four root colors, then there are secondary colors, there are, you know, certain shapes, and then they are the object of an eye consciousness, then you have sound, you have different kinds of sound. So these are the things we understand, but we never, you know, never thought about them in this way, or never used this tool to investigate them, right? So that's the first part of the collected topics, where you just look at colors. What is, you know, how many main primary colors are there? How many secondary colors are there? You could debate, you know, what is the primary color? What isn't? It's not really the primary colors in Tibetan Buddhism, or the way they describe them, are not the same as in physics. There are blue, yellow, white, and red. Those are the primary colors, the prime colors, right? And then any other color is the secondary color. But it doesn't matter. It's just we have to categorize it in one way, so this is the way they categorize those colors. So even though green is also in the prayer flex, and green is, but that's the secondary color. And then black and so forth, they're all secondary colors. Okay. Anyway, so, and then you have long and short and the different shapes, round, squared, etc. Now, what you're trying to do is, well, first you say, you know, the subject, the color of this cup, it is yellow because it is, you know, suitable to be called yellow or whatever, you know, some bizarre reason that really doesn't make, but it's just in order to get this idea. So you basically have these three parts to something. So A is B because it's C. This is kind of your structure. You want to say something about something, and there's always a reason for saying so. It's like in everyday life. I want to prove something to someone, and so I give a reason. Or if I prove you wrong, I will say, well, when you think that, then A is necessarily B because you assert C, right? So there's always a reason for that. So you can actually discuss anything if you take that structure. A is B because of C. And A is C because it's, right? And you can take it from there. And then the other person, so that's for me as a debater, I use this threefold structure. A is B because of C. So the syllogism, that's the syllogism. Socrates is immortal because he's a man. Or this cup is impermanent because it changes moment by moment. That would also be a correct statement. Now, for the person sitting down, they basically have what are called the four answers. There are more than four, actually. There is a way in which you can also give another answer. But in general, there's four answers. So when I say something, if I start a debate, I try to find out what the other person is thinking. So I would say, the subject, this cup, it is impermanent. So the other person, to just these two parts now, A is B, they can either agree or disagree, right? So there's agreement and disagreement. It makes two answers. Either they say, I accept. The subject, the cup, it is impermanent. I accept. Okay. So I already know they think this cup is impermanent, right? But they could also, what else could they say? If they didn't say they agreed, what else could they say? I disagree. No, what they say, why? But it's the same as saying, I mean, this is implying I disagree. Okay, this cup is impermanent. I agree. And then you just say something else. I mean, I'm not going to ask again because I'm still going to hear I agree. So this cup is impermanent. This cup changes moment by moment. I agree. This cup can never go out of existence. Oh, why? Right? Okay. So why? Well, then I could say because its continuum goes on. The continuum cannot be cut, even though it becomes something else, but there's a continuum there afterwards. Okay. Anyway, so this would be just... Anyway, so the moment I posit a reason, so first I say A is B. So they say either I agree or they say why. Two questions. Then I posit a reason. With the why, they tell me they want a reason. So when you have a reason given, there's only two answers you can give. You're left with two reasons left. Okay, so if I say, for example, the subject, what's your name? Your name, yes, yes. Carl. The subject, Carl. The subject, Carl, is a woman. What would you say? Why? I know, I knew you disagree, but you don't say I disagree, you say why. Because Carl is a woman because he's a human being. Okay? Okay, so now you cannot say why. I mean, anyway, do you agree he's a human being, right? You agree. So you agree. If you think of this three structure, A, B, and C, you agree A being C. You agree that Carl is a human being, right? There's nothing wrong with saying Carl is a human being. So Carl is a woman, that's the problem. Carl being a woman is the problem. But Carl is a woman because it's a human being? The human being part, we don't have a problem with that, right? So what do we have a problem with? With the pervasion. It's called the pervasion. It's a funny word. Kaba in Tibetan. It's actually saying that whatever is C is not necessarily B. So even though Carl is a man, is a human being, but whoever is a human being is not necessarily a woman. So this is where the problem lies, right? So there's no problem with saying Carl is a human being, but that doesn't prove that Carl is a woman. It cannot prove that. Why not? Because whoever is a human being is not necessarily a woman. Okay? So therefore, there's why first, then there's a reason given, but the reason is incorrect. Why? Because whatever is that reason is not necessarily that which I tried to prove. So the subject is A, B is called the predicate, and C is the reason. So B is the predicate. So, I don't have a whiteboard here, but I don't need one. But if I had one, I would write subject, right, predicate, and reason. Okay? Subject, predicate, reason. So if you have that in your notes or just in front of you, you understand the basic structure. A is B because it's C. If the other person agrees that A is B, then that's it. You don't need to give a reason. They say, I agree. But when they don't agree, they ask why, and you need to give a reason. And then they have the opportunity to answer. They have to answer because they've disagreed. So they have to say there's something wrong with the reason. And there's only two ways in which the reason can be wrong. Either there's no pervasion, as in like whatever C is not necessarily B, or A is not C. So in this case, Carl is a human being, so there's no problem, right? But if I said, for example, Carl, the subject Carl, is a woman because he's a 15-year-old teenager. Or let's say, okay, you wouldn't say a woman, but, okay, let's say he's a woman because he's a 45-year-old woman, right? So I say he's a woman because he's a 45-year-old woman. Whoever is a 45-year-old woman is necessarily a woman. So no problem there. But Carl is not a 45-year-old woman. So that's where the problem lies. So if you give an incorrect statement, both of those could be wrong, that A is not C and C is not necessarily B, that's possible, or one of the two is incorrect. Whichever it is, there's no third possibility. If you say A is B because it's C, and since A is not B, whatever you give for C, either there's no pervasion or A is not C, or both, right? That's what this is based on. I know it's a little complicated, but if you hear it, I'll say it one more time. I mean, that's just the logic of things, right? So, the example back. Okay, so Carl, the subject Carl, that's A, is a woman because he's a human being. Okay, saying he's already, I'm giving, but never mind. He's a human being, right? Okay, so the other person has not agreed when I said Carl is a woman, right? Just say, why? So now I have to give a reason. I mean, no way I can prove it. Like, no way I can prove it, right? So whatever I say, but okay, I say because he's a human being. So in this case, you need to say there's no pervasion. The answer would be there's no pervasion, which is saying the reason does not pervade the predicate. It doesn't make sense in English. I know it doesn't make sense. But I don't know how else I would say this. I have no better word for it. In Tibetan, it's kabamanchong, which basically means the pervasion is not established or it's not there. There's no pervasion. So whoever is a human being is not necessarily a woman because, well, Carl or Joe or Tom, whatever, right? Okay. Or a small whiteboard? No, so far I'm fine. Thanks. I mean, when you feel like it's harder to follow, then I would maybe ask for a whiteboard. But I think right now we're fine. Does this still make sense to everyone? Yeah. So, but again, I could give another example. Well, Carl, I could try to prove it differently. Carl is a human being. Carl is a woman because he's a 45-year-old woman. In this case, there's a pervasion. Whatever it's C is necessarily B. Whoever is a 45-year-old woman is necessarily a woman. But Carl just doesn't happen to be a 45-year-old woman, right? Okay. Or I could say, Carl is a woman because he is a chair. Whoever's a chair is not necessarily a woman. And Carl is not a chair. So then both are wrong. Okay. Now, these are the four answers, therefore. And then I say the reason is not established. Sorry, I need to say that. So when I say Carl is a woman because he's a 45-year-old woman, in that case, I don't say there's no pervasion because whoever is a 45-year-old woman is necessary. I say the reason is not established. I'm just saying A is not C. Okay? So these are the four answers. These are the four answers. First, there's a statement A is B, so you ask, either you agree, and then that's it. And then the person continues with some other statements, right? Or you say, I don't agree. And then the other person needs to reply. Then you say why. The other person says why. So me, the debater, I say A is B, and if the other person doesn't agree, they ask why, which forces me to give a reason. And then according to that reason, I say either the reason is not established or there's no pervasion, right? Okay. But of course I could be proven totally wrong and then I have nothing. I'm left speechless. And that's the perfect scenario. Because then I have to let go of saying, well, before previously I said A is not B. By saying why, I'm implying I don't think A is B. But then I realize A has to be B. Okay? So this is kind of the structure. But it doesn't mean that whenever I say something, I could give a totally correct reason, but the person has to answer something, right? So sometimes you just have all these wrong views. You say the reason is not established, even though it is actually established. So then I have to prove that the reason is established, right? And even though it sounds impossible to do anything with this, it seems very limiting, it actually isn't. So now what I want to do is give you the example of a debate. That's probably the best, you know, to establish this. Okay. So remember what I said to you. First of all, there's the structure of these three. And on top of that, I never say anything directly. I kind of point out the absurdities by way of this example. All right. So let me give you one explanation. So when we first start to study, we start about colors, as I just said. But as we move on then, when we get a good understanding of colors and how they relate to, you know, mind and so forth, then we take existence, we look at existence itself. And we basically make a chart of, you know, existence. How can that be divided? That's what we do. That's the second topic of the collected topics. It's about, well, first, what does it mean to be existing, right? Okay. Something that can be proven by valid cognition or, you know. So that can, then anything that exists, it's either permanent or impermanent. You make that kind of division. It's either changing moment by moment, or it's not changing moment by moment. Those are the two possibilities. And then, of course, our main focus is on impermanent things. It's not saying that they're more impermanent things, but those are the things we deal with every day. You know, impermanent things, our mind, our body, the things around us, they're all impermanent. So we look at impermanent phenomena, and we put up a new category. One category is a threefold category, physical things, physicality. It's the word that's used as form. But people find it a little difficult because form and shape are used interchangeably. So when I teach in Israel, they don't really have a good word for form, or they have a good word for form, but it implies shape. So people are not happy with the word form, so we started using the word physicality. Okay, something that is physical. All right. So what does it mean, something that is physical? I guess you could say anything that can be perceived by the sense consciousnesses. By the eye consciousness, ear consciousness, can be. Of course, you know, very subtle phenomena. But if our eye had the capacity to see the subtle atoms, we would be able to see them. And we can see them, of course, you know, by using machines, for example. That enables us to perceive them. So anything that is, yeah, physical, right? That is called form or physicality. That's one category. So as I just said, it includes shapes, colors, sounds, tastes, tangible objects, smells. Yeah. So these are the physical objects. It includes our body. Okay? Our body is a physical object. So we have something physical. Okay. The next category, does anyone know what's the next category? If you take the body as one, well, you need another one then. The mind. Okay, great. That's the mental. So then the next category is the mental. Is mind, if you like, or consciousness. Consciousness, awareness. So there's physicality, then there's consciousness. Yeah? Or form. So anything that is physical, and then there's the mind. So that's the next category. But you have a third category of something which is neither the first two. It's neither physical, nor mind, nor mental. Yeah? Nor awareness. What could that be? What could that be? Something that is impermanent, but it's neither physical. It's not physical, nor mental, nor an awareness or a consciousness. What could that be?
Time.
Very good. Time is a good example. Very good. Time is impermanent. Time changes moment by moment, therefore it's impermanent. It's neither physical. It depends on physical, but that's different. It's nor it's mental. We have a mind that perceives it, but that's different. Okay, very good. Time is a good example. Something else.
Karma.
Very good. Karma is another example. Nice. What else? Pardon? No, the wind is a physical object, something you can perceive with your body consciousness.
Yeah.
What else? Empty space. What do you mean with empty space? Just the space in front of us? That's physical. Well, that doesn't mean that it's not physical. Something you can perceive, still physical. Yeah. So empty space, unfortunately, but it's physical, yeah.
Dates?
The days of the week. Oh, right. That's like time, right? Yes, yes, yes. So you're right, but that would kind of go into the category, right? A year, a day, a month. Yes, absolutely. What else?
A label, like a name.
A name. A name is sound, right? It's sound. It's physical, right? Carl. Carl is an example of the thing. Carl is not physical. Carl has something physical. Carl is not mental. Carl has a mind. But Carl is neither physical nor a mind. It's not his consciousness. Carl is something, sorry, I mean someone, something, who possesses the two, physical and mental, right? But Carl is the third category. Okay? Okay? So Carl is, you know, of course, if you want to take it, Carl is imputed on his mind and body, but is none of the two. Carl is not his mind, Carl is not his body. Does that make sense? Well, Carl is not the label. Carl is labeled on the basis of mind and body. What is the label of the third category? Of course, I'm sorry. It's that which is neither. a compositional factor that is neither. It's a weird word. It's yeah. Demenduji in Tibetan. It's a little shorter in Tibetan. So you see, this is this threefold category. You have physicality. The threefold category of impermanent phenomena. Physicality, mind, and that which is neither. Such as Carl. Okay. So now, having laid that out, and it makes sense, doesn't it? Of course you could categorize it in a different way too. This is totally up to the person, but the Buddha put it forth that way, and we might as well go along with this category. Okay. So taking that as the category, now comes the debate. A white horse. Okay, a white horse. A white horse. A white horse is a horse, right? A white horse is permanent or impermanent? Impermanent. If Carl is impermanent, the white horse is too, right? Okay, so the white horse. Is the white horse of the three categories? Which category does it belong to? Physicality. Someone said physicality. It's neither. It has a physical body, of course. But that's what there's more to a horse, right, than just the physical. A horse has a mind, too. Okay, it's a living being, like Carl. A different type of living being, but nonetheless a living being. Okay. Excuse me. So, therefore, the white horse. Okay, the white horse. So the white horse is the third category. Okay? But it has a color. Yes, please, Carl. No, White Horse Joe works the same way. White Horse Joe that's standing over there, you know, in the courtyard, wherever. No, it's a white horse. It's a, you know, if you just want to look, is it changing moment by moment? Yes. Does it have physicality? Yes. Is it physical? No, it's not physical. It's a living being, right? So, just that. I mean, just try to put it in this category. Now, we said it has a color. Okay? So, colors. Colors, are they physical or mental? Or neither? They're physical, right? White, blue, green, they're all physical, aren't they? Okay, so whatever is white as a color, it's a physicality. It's something you can see with your eyes, right? With your eye consciousness. Okay, sounds, they're all physical. Okay, so whatever is white is necessarily a color. Therefore, now the question is the white horse white? Is the white horse white? In everyday life, you would say yes, and I'm not saying don't say that anymore. No, you can still use that. But to be very, if we have that kind of way of categorizing, and this is pretty random, you could decide it is or not, but really from the point of view of this explanation here, and when we do these introductory kind of topics, there's still kind of room for debate, you could decide it is or it's not, but let's just decide on this category that I've just given you. Now the question that arises is the white horse white or not? Okay. Who says yes? Great. Great. She's saying the white horse is white. Wonderful. You're saying the white horse is white. Good, good, very good. You're saying white horse is white. Wonderful. Okay. So how would I debate now? Because if you say it's not, and I'm not as mean to say why not, but for the sake of the debate, now how would I debate? Okay. And I will show to you how this threefold structure allows me to prove, and it's to be seen whether you agree or not. I would claim I prove, but of course, it's again, whether you agree or not is a different matter. But how it would be used, so you get a sense for it, how this threefold structure is used to prove that the white horse is not white. Okay, so how would I do this? I would say, Susan, right? Oh, so Susan said the white horse is not white. So therefore, okay, so the subject, the white horse, it follows that it's not, sorry, it's white. She's saying it's white. It follows that it's white. She says, I agree. Right? She doesn't have to say why. So I establish this. Okay? Then I say, well, the subject, the white horse, it follows it's not a horse. She says, why? She wouldn't agree with that. It follows it's not a horse. She says, why? I say, because it's not a living being. What does she say? The reason is not established. Whatever is not a living being is necessarily not a horse. She's right with that. With that pervasion, she's right with that, right? This is a little harder because now you need to think of negatives. It was much easier when I said Carl is a woman because he is a human being. It's easy, right? Whoever is a human being is necessarily a woman, but Carl, but there's no, no, sorry. Whoever is a human being is not necessarily a woman. That's a little easier. But when I add not, then it gets harder. Whoever is not a living being is necessarily not a woman. Right? Yeah. Okay? So, this is a little difficult here. So whoever is a human being is not necessarily a woman, but whoever is a woman is necessarily a living being. And whoever is not a living being is necessarily not a woman. Yeah, it's a little complicated, but if you do this a couple of times, it becomes easy, right? It's really not that hard. It's just not, we're not used to thinking that way. But when I say it, we all understand it. Okay. So therefore, what did we say before? The white horse. Okay, getting back to the white horse. The subject, the white horse. She agrees it's white. Okay. The subject, the white horse. It follows, or it is not a living, not a horse. She says, why? Because it's not a living being. She agrees that whatever is not a living being is necessarily not a horse, but she does not agree that the white horse is not a living being. So she says the reason is not established. A is not C. The white horse, it's wrong to say that the white horse is not a living being. Okay, then I say, the subject, the white horse, it is not a living being because it does not belong to the third category of being neither physical nor mental. She says, I do not agree. The reason is not established. The reason is not established, right? I say, the white horse, it is not a living being. She says, why? Because it does not belong to the category of being neither physical nor mental. She says, the reason is not established. Then I say, the white horse does not belong to the category that is neither physical or mental because it belongs to the category of being physical. She says, the reason is not established. I said, it belongs to that category because it's a color. She says, the reason is not established. I say, it is a color because it's white. What to say? Right? There was a logical kind of, it came, you know, like there's a logical, so either she needs to let go of saying it is not white. And of course, as I said, this is pretty random. So we can debate whether you can have something as a living being and a color at the same time. This is different to impermanent and permanent. It's just for the training of debate. But let's assume we've totally agreed that these three categories are mutually exclusive. You cannot have something that is all three. Or, you know, more than just one of those categories. So living being is either physical or it's this category which is neither. Right? So there's no other way around it. And whatever is white must be a color. So then if you say the white horse is white, it has to be a color. And if it's a color, it must be a physicality. Then it cannot be a living being. So you see how basically didn't say, that was wrong. The white horse is not a color. It's not white because it's not a color. No, I said, I didn't say that. I said the white horse is not a living being. It's not a white horse. The white horse is not a horse because it's not a living being. Right? It's not a living being because it's not this third category. It is not that third category because it's the physical category. It's the physical category because it's a color. It's a color because it's white. Original statement. Yeah? So you can see if you're a chess player, and I'm hopeless when it comes to playing chess. But the little I learned, it's like someone makes a mistake here. So you don't right away. No, you go around and then goes the queen or whatever, right? Yeah? So in that way, you need to think, you know, to and then you get them back. You point out their own mistake until they cannot give any of the four answers. They're speechless. And so they need to let go of something because they cannot say the reason is not established. If she were to say because it's white, okay, the white horse is not a living being because it's white, or the white horse is a color because it's white, she cannot say there's no pervasion because whatever is white is necessarily a color. She agrees to that. She cannot say the white horse is not white because that's the original statement. She's speechless. And then she lets go of her view. She lets go of it. So that's kind of the idea. Yeah? Or she needs to say something out, you know, need to change. Because that's just the logic. You can actually put someone in this corner. And it's not about putting someone in that corner. It's not about, like, winning or losing. It's a win-win situation for both parties, actually. Even if you were able to disprove the other person, you may learn so much from it. And for the other person, there's less benefit. So it's really not about that. It's about just learning better, understanding better. But it gives you a sense how you can use this threefold structure by disproving that something. And you could also present wrong reasons. It sometimes happens too, that are not logically consistent. And you think they're right. I mean, this is just part of the whole process. But the ideal case is that you can use the logical reasoning to such a degree that you understand that whatever is that is necessarily that. Whatever is that is necessarily that. This chain, right? I mean, you've seen the chain. Whatever is white is necessarily color. Whatever is a color is necessarily a physicality. Whatever is a horse is necessarily a living being. Whatever is a living being is necessarily belongs to the category of being neither. And whatever belongs to the category of being neither is necessarily not a physicality. So you understand this relationship. And how do you understand? You see, there's a lot about whatever is that necessarily the other or not? Right? Whoever is a human being, is he or she necessarily impermanent? Right? So you start thinking in those terms. Is whatever this necessarily that? How do they relate? And it's a slow process. I mean, I'm sure, like, just presenting this to you, many of you may be thinking, how the heck can you actually spend hours doing this? But it's like anything, you know, like weight watching. I can maybe weight, you know, I know I can lift weight 1 kilo. Right? And it will be like that for like months. I can wait, you know, lift one kilo. And a day or later I can do 2 and 3. And in the end people can do 100 kilo. How is that possible? It's just time and constant training. Yeah? But it becomes second nature. As weird it may seem, it becomes second nature. Okay. But I want to introduce something to you which we also learn. We also learn initially. Later on, you can do it automatically. You don't need to do that. What we do initially, we keep asking, in a debate context, using exactly that same structure, and I will show you how in a moment. I would just present to you a debate. We want to understand how things relate to one another, right? How do I relate to any of you? How does the characteristic of impermanence relate to any of us? Okay? So when I say relate, it doesn't mean like blood relationship, of course not. It kind of means certain characteristics. Who has those characteristics? What has those characteristics? Is there other things that have these characteristics? So, let me just take something very easy. Human being and being a woman. What is the relationship? What is the relationship between human being and female? Let's say a woman means actually human being, right? And then female, it's a different kind of category altogether. So you have a category. I mean, everything is a category. I mean, even, you know, Carl, I know your name now, so sorry for forgetting everyone else's name. Oh, no, Jackie. So Jackie is a category. Why is Jackie a category? Because there's yesterday's Jackie and today's Jackie and tomorrow's Jackie, right? There's a number of Jackies, okay, in that way. In terms of time, she's a continuum in time. There are moments there. So there's another category. So phenomena can be seen as such categories, if you like. I mean, just for the sake of keeping it simple. So, if you take, for example, human and woman, how do they relate? So then you ask yourself, is whatever is one the other or not? This is like the always the question. You have two things. Is whatever this if you call them X and Y? Is whatever is X necessarily Y? Is whatever is Y necessarily X? Is there something which is both? Is there something which is neither? Right? Okay. So I know it may sound very dry and boring possibly, but when you do it a couple of times, it's a great training. And it allows you, when you understand the relationship between things, you start doing it right away. How do things relate to one another? And it's very beneficial for the debate. Very beneficial. Because you have that in your mind. Right? It doesn't take long. You can posit the relationship. And it allows you to use a syllogism effectively. And I'll show you how in a moment, right? Okay. So, when you have two things, such as X and Y, or such as human being and woman, there's only four ways in which they can relate to one another. Either they're contradictory, which means there's nothing which is both. There's nothing which is a woman and a human being. That would be one possibility, right? I'm not saying it's that. Or it could be equivalent, exactly the same. Whatever is a human being must be a woman, whatever is a woman must be a human being, or whoever, I should say, right? That's another possibility. So either they're equivalent or they're totally contradictory. That's second possibility. Or they could have what are called 3 points, which means whatever is one is necessarily the other, but whatever is the other is not necessarily the one. But there's something which is both. Okay? So 3 points. I mean, there's also something which is neither, but they don't consider that. So X and Y, or woman and human being. Whatever is X is necessarily Y. But whatever is Y is not necessarily X. And there's something which is both. Right? That would be another possibility between two things. Okay. And then there's the other possibility, the third possibility, which means 4 points. It said, there's whatever is X is not necessarily Y. Whatever is Y is not necessarily X. But there's something which is both and there's something which is neither. Okay. So these are, I know it's complicated, but honestly, if you do that a couple of times, it gets easy. For everyone. So, woman and human being, are they contradictory? Is there something which is both a woman and a human being? Absolutely. So we can definitely exclude Jackie, for example, is a woman and a human being. So there's something which is both. So human and woman cannot be contradictory. Okay. Are they equivalent? No. Whoever is a woman is not necessarily, whoever is a woman is necessarily a human being. But it doesn't go both ways. Okay. All right. So then you have 3 points left and 4 points left. 4 points, just to remind you, whatever is X is not necessarily Y, but whatever is Y is also not necessarily X. So does that 4-point relationship apply to human and no? No. Very good. So human and there are 3 points between human and, what's it called? Human and woman. A woman and a human being. There's this. So one includes the other, right? One includes the other. So it includes more than just woman. Human being includes also man, or maybe transgenders if you like. But nonetheless, there's a relationship. There's something which is both. They're not totally contradictory. Okay. An example of something which is contradictory. Is there an example of something that is whatever is the one is not necessarily not the other. Whatever is the other is necessarily not the one. There's nothing which is both. Can you come up with an example? Man and woman, yes. Man and woman, very good. Man and woman, right? I mean, transgender is neither man or woman, you could say, right? So, what else? This cushion and that cushion, right? You and I, okay? So that's easy, okay? How about impermanent and Carl? Carl and impermanent. 3 points. 3 points, right? Something which is both. But which way does it work with the kind of whatever is this is necessarily this, whatever is this is necessarily? Which one is correct and which one? Whatever is Carl, I say whatever, it's weird. In Tibetan it works, but English sounds a little grammatically incorrect. So whatever is Carl, whoever is Carl is necessarily impermanent. Whoever is impermanent, not necessarily Carl. Jackie. Right? Great. You see, you're all getting it. It's not that hard. It's not that hard. I mean, it's just weird to think in those ways. But you're making new connections in your brain. And, you know, before you know, it becomes easier. Okay. Now, a challenge. Give me an example of something that has 4 points. An example of something that is 4 points. I've already said it. So, there's something which is both the two things. There's something which is neither of those two things. And whatever is the one is not necessarily the other. Whatever is the other is not necessarily the one. Ah, your brain, I can hear this. I can see the steam coming. A human and a female. Very good. A human and a female. Let's see. Whoever is human is not necessarily a female. Whoever is female is not necessarily a human being. There's something which is both. Female and a human being. Jackie. There's something which is neither. Neither human nor female. The carpet. Great. There you go. So you see, if you have two things, two existences, they're always related in either they're equivalent, contradictory, have those 3 points or 4 points. This is what we learn initially, to understand this relationship, because it all comes down to understanding interdependence. So phenomena are connected, but even though Jackie and I are connected, that does not mean we cannot be contradictory, because contradictory just means there's nothing which is both of us. But there's also someone who is equivalent with Jackie. Can you give me an example of something that is equivalent with Jackie? But don't say Jackie again, not Jackie and Jackie. I mean, that's just the same. But something equivalent with Jackie.
Jill.
Pardon? So whoever is Jill is necessarily Jackie, and whatever is Jackie is necessarily Jill? No. The previous moment of Jackie. Is the previous moment of Jackie necessarily Jackie? Yes. Is wherever is Jackie necessarily the previous moment of Jackie?
No.
Only three. 3 points. Okay.
The daughter of Jackie's mother.
I need to say, I need a moment for that. The daughter of Jackie's mother. Great. Well, does she have another daughter? Do you have a sister? So is the daughter of Jackie's mother necessarily Jackie?
Ah.
Is she the first daughter of Jackie's mother?
Second daughter.
Okay, that it also would work. I can cheat here. Not Jackie.
Yeah, not
Jackie. Opposite of not Jackie. Right? Two knots. You know, just kind of count like the way I used to do it. Two, three. Opposite is just, you know, the opposite of not Jackie. It's not the same as Jackie. I mean, it appears differently to the mind, right? They're not identical. I'm not saying Jackie. If I say Jackie, it doesn't make sense. They're totally identical, right? But if I say opposite of not Jackie and Jackie, equivalent, right? So why would that be important to have equivalence? Why would I want to know that? Well, lack of inherent existence, lack of intrinsic existence are equivalent, right? So it's just using different words to describe the same thing. But words are powerful. Words are powerful, so you can use different words to describe the same thing, and they appear differently to people's minds. So I have those equivalent things, right? Okay, I can describe Jackie, or I could say, if you're the second daughter of your mother, I don't know, but let's say, are you the second daughter? The third daughter of your mother. So the third daughter of your mother, I learned something about Jackie that I didn't know before by using that idea, right? The daughter of Jackie's mother. I know more about her family now, instead of just saying Jackie, right? Okay. So it's like, you know, using language in a different way. So you have something that's equivalent, but because you have two different words describing the same thing. Yeah. Okay. And, of course, contradictory doesn't mean we cannot connect and we cannot influence one another, but still, there's nothing which is both of us. We're still contradictory. And contradictory, the words kind of are mutually exclusive, is sometimes the words that's used. So you see, it can be helpful if you start looking at things, especially when it comes to when you do your study. Okay? So if you sometimes study like in a difficult concept, you know, something that you find difficult to really grasp, what does it mean to be a living being? What does it mean, you know, this mind as opposed to that mind? So, and then look at the minds, you know, are they contradictory? What is the relationship? Maybe 3 points, maybe 4 points, right? And so in that way, you form in your mind already a way in which phenomena exist. You start doing this, and you start getting better at that. Again, with time, you get better at that. And
course you use it in the debate. We do it all the time, you know? We look at things that are singular and things that are plural. An important idea, something that is one and something that is different, right? Different as in like not just one, but two or three or more, okay? So these are also different, these are also important aspects of like something just one or is it different, right? I mean, Jackie, an opposite of not Jackie, they're not one. They appear differently to the mind. They're separate. They're two separate phenomena, but still equivalent. So because they appear differently to the mind, they're said to be different. But they still refer to the same phenomenon. Yeah? So we take those phenomena. What is the relationship between one and Jackie? What is the relationship between being one, being a single thing, and Jackie? What is the relationship between the two? 3 points. Okay, great. What's your name?
Scott.
So, all right, that's right. Okay, Scott and one. So just now you made a mistake. Thank you. Now I can use the debate technique. Okay? So Scott is saying there's 3 possibilities between Jackie and one. So what do I need to do? I'm not going to say, hey, Scott, that was wrong because da-da-da-da. No. I need to find something. I need to find a mistake. Where's the mistake? Well, the mistake is whoever is Jackie is not necessarily one. Whoever is Jackie is not necessarily one. So what do I posit? Jackie, that is not one. I could say yesterday's Jackie and today's Jackie. It follows she's one. They're one. Yesterday's Jackie's and today's Jackie are Jackie, right? They're both instances of Jackie. I know it sounds weird when we use the language that way. We don't talk that way. Yesterday is Jackie and today is Jackie, you know, or like yesterday myself and today myself. I start having to say we, right? It's kind of weird. It's kind of multiple personality kind of weirdness. But basically, yesterday's me and today's me are not the same person. Honestly, right? To be really, that we think, oh, I'm just this one solid person, unchanging. That's kind of the sense I have of myself. But actually, a second ago, I, and the second before that, I, they're all different. My mind has changed. My body has changed. Since there's no separate I from those, what is there that's the same like it was a moment ago? So really, there's a continuum of I, which is singular. The continuum is singular, but it's made up of different moments. So when I take yesterday's I and today's I end up with being two I's, two different ones. Are they both Kelsawamo? Yes, they are. Just as yesterday's Jackie is Jackie. It's not like you were Jill yesterday and Jackie today. No, there's yesterday's Jackie and there's today's Jackie. Right? So therefore, yesterday's Jackie and today's Jackie are Jackie. Are they one? According to what he said whatever is Jackie is necessarily one. Regarding the subject, yesterday and today's Jackie, are they one? You say, why? Because they're Jackie. Right? So you cannot say they're not Jackie. So you have to say there's no pervasion, which means whatever is Jackie is not necessarily one. Right? So it gives you more of a sense of how this debate is used. I'm not saying you're wrong because Jackie is not, you know, Jackie can be two. I don't say that to you. I say, oh, great. Whoever is Jackie is necessarily one. Well, how about yesterday's Jackie and today Jackie? They must be one because they're Jackie, right? So this is like a straightforward way. And if you train in this, it comes natural. It's not that hard. But we need to see how we use language and how there are inconsistencies in a way. Oh, there's just one Jackie, right? There's a sense of Jackie being this solid one thing, right? And I had that sense. The Kesawamo who came out of the car and the Kesawamo was sitting here right now, it's the same. As if there was like this consistent, permanent I that I was carrying around. Yes, body changed, mind changed, but I didn't. I am that same person, that solid I, right? But actually, each moment is individually different. It's just a continuum. So this is how these basic ideas help us to already break through this a little bit. Yeah? But you need to have that training. You need to do it again and again and again. And this you can do. You could do it on your own already. This would be already something. So when you look at your Lumrim text, right, and you see a category, maybe that would be something that would be helpful. I mean, this idea of making charts. Because in a way, this tool of comparing phenomena relationship. If I have a category, I have like an overarching, I don't really know how you call that. Like, for example, impermanent can be divided into three. So the three is the category of impermanent. So if I have such a relationship that something can be categorized into three, each of the categories and that thing must have all three possibilities. So physicality and impermanent, three possibilities. Mind and impermanent, three possibilities. That which is neither and impermanent, three possibilities, always. Or if you take existent, can be divided into impermanent and permanent. Right? Existent. Whatever is impermanent must be existent. Whatever is permanent must be existent. Whatever exists doesn't have to be permanent. Whatever exists doesn't have to be impermanent. So whenever you have a category and you can divide them into two, right, you know that each of the categories with that which is categorized, those two must have three possibilities, right? So human being, woman, human being, man. Man and human being, three points. Three possibilities is another way of saying 3 points, right? Whoever is a woman is necessarily human. Whoever is human is not necessarily a woman. But there's something which is both. Same with man. Okay? So then, if you understand that, that is always the case when you have a category. So you learn something and maybe put them in categories. Make charts. Okay, for example, give me an example of something you've learned in the Lamrim Chemo where you could do this category. Something, it can be divided into this, that, and the other. Can you give me an example of something you've learned? Something that comes to mind. Very good. The qualifications of a teacher. A qualified teacher is a category. Not just teacher, because you can have, you know, kind of the fake teachers like myself. But the like a teacher, right? A qualified teacher. And then his or her qualities, right? Wait, I need to think myself there. There you go. The qualities of a teacher. The quality of, what would be a quality you can think of? To hold the lineage, for example. Okay. All right, let's say that's an example. So whoever holds that lineage is a qualified teacher. Well, I guess here it's a little harder. You need to have all those qualities come together, and then it's a quality of a teacher. But still, even though it's here a little different, but still you start looking at that. Okay, is whoever has a teacher has to have all those qualities? Is whoever has all these qualities a qualified teacher? Is one quality is sufficient? You see how you're already doing this? And it gives you a better understanding. So it's basically this constantly, is whatever this necessarily that? Is whatever that necessarily this? Yeah? And however difficult it may be, and for some of you it may be easier and for some of you it might be harder, depending on what your background is, depending on your job, depending on how many brain games you play, because that helps. You know, these kind of... But don't be discouraged. It doesn't matter. There's like parts that you're better at and the other person struggles more with. There's so many parts to it. So you may initially have maybe more difficulty with understanding the pervasions, but then, you know, if you've done this for some time, you will see there's another strength that you have. So it's very, very uniquely, and so whoever is still feeling like, you know, don't be discouraged. It doesn't mean anything. But if he gives you just this sense, so whatever you've studied in the Lamrim Chemo, for example, is whatever it is necessarily that. That's a very helpful. Just this is whatever is this necessarily that. Is whatever is this necessarily not that? That's also another way of asking. Is it something which is both? Something this is neither? It's a very helpful way to start structuring things and see where they belong to. Other examples. Are there any other examples you could come up with? Yes, please. Should I walk through that? As a direction. All teachings are directions for practice. Okay, I need to check again. What do you mean exactly with that? You want me to talk about that? So all teachings and instructions for practice. Okay. Is whatever is a teaching necessarily instruction for practice? Is whatever is an instruction for practice necessarily a teaching? In that way, right? Okay. Is whatever is a teaching necessarily an instruction for practice? I'm saying only teaching. She did not.
Valid. Sorry.
No. Okay, let me just still ask. Is whatever is a teaching necessarily an instruction? No, I'm not refuting what you're saying, but I'm trying to to trick you. Is whatever is a question, and that's what you tried to do on the debate ground, by the way, too. Ah, someone just said a teaching, right? Okay, great. Is whatever is a teaching necessarily instruction for practice? No. Give me an example. Posit something. Okay, great. The alphabet, the teaching on the alphabet, that's not an instruction. It's helpful for practicing. You would want to know it, but even if you don't know it, you can still practice, right? Great. Okay, what else? A teaching that is not an instruction for a practice. Maybe even the opposite of an instruction for a practice. A teaching on how to rob a bank or something.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, right? A teaching on how to rob a bank. You know, something bizarre that really doesn't. Great. So whatever is a teaching is not necessarily instruction for practice. Is whatever is an instruction for a practice necessarily a teaching? Yeah, you could kind of say that. An instruction, that's kind of like, yeah, so like even just the verse, an instruction, it's a teaching. Right? It's a teaching. Wow, so it makes sense to be respectful towards the sign because it's an instruction of the, and therefore it's a teaching, even if it's just one line. Right? So therefore to say, their equivalent is not correct, so we need to add something to make the two equivalent, an instruction for practice and a teaching. We need to add something to teaching, because teaching is too vast. What would you add? Yes, a valid Dharma teaching or Buddhist teaching, yeah. So those two are, you see? Okay, great. Right? So, is whatever a teaching is an instruction. If you understand that, then you take teachings as such. They're an instruction, directly or indirectly.
What about an instruction on how not to?
Oh, how about an instruction? His question was, how about an instruction on how not to practice? Is that necessarily a practice of how to practice? Is that a teaching? Is that a Dharma teaching? Very good. An instruction on how not to practice. That's a tricky one. That's a very good one. How about an instruction on how not to practice? Is that a teaching? Is that a valid Dharma teaching? Right? Could you give me an example of an instruction on not to how to, just for those who still maybe think, oh, that's not really a teaching. But let's look at an instruction of how not to practice. The 10 on virtues, very good. Or on how not to listen, I mean, not to be like a vessel turned upside down. Right? Very good. What did you say, the 37 practices? Right. So anything like don't do this, you know, when your neighbor snores while you're meditating, don't hit him or something, right? Something like that. Okay, great. So that is an instruction. Is that an instruction? Is that a Dharma instruction? And how to practice the Dharma? Yes. So instruction on how not to practice the Dharma is actually an instruction on how to practice the Dharma because you didn't negate one action and therefore you're left with the absence of that action, of the restraint. Instruction. Isn't that an instruction on how to practice to restrain yourself?
I'm not.
Maybe. Good. I love this. You see, this is already a debate happening. You may not be clapping and jumping around and, you know, and take your mala, yes, and do all that. Initially, actually, that's very difficult. You know how we learn to debate? Just for a break. Just a story for now. How we learn to debate, it's so funny actually when you think about it. We had a debate, a stylized debate that we memorized. We memorized a debate where you had all the questions and all the answers, right? And then they made us go to the debate ground and made us recite this and do the movements, right? I mean, either you first just sit down and don't do the movements because honestly, thinking and doing the movements at the same time, it's impossible. One of those you get confused with. So you could either choose to just sit there and do the debate until you can do the movements, or you do the movements and you just pretend you're debating. So we did the second. That's how it's done. So my friends were so impressed. They could see me on the debate ground going, and so it was just memorized, right? And it looked so real. And it was, they didn't realize we were just doing the same debate over and over. I did it 3 times, then I sat down, then the other person got up, did it 3 times, I had all the answers, he had all the answers, and that was it. That's how we learned to debate. But after 2 weeks of that, and my friends being terribly impressed, thinking I was debating, my friends means like people who didn't know Tibetan and came to the debate ground. And I didn't know Tibetan. When I first started, I hardly knew any Tibetan, but I could say that. So, I mean, I finished at the end of my debate and be like, could only say in English, like, bye, see you later. I couldn't even speak anything. So, like, we did that this way, and then afterwards, I could, the moment I said, yimbatal, or like, you know, da-da-da-da, like, with all the end of the sentence, I could clap my hand in the right moment. And all I had to do now was exchange it. And sometimes you forget to clap, and, you know, but it was a great way for about a week, no, I'm exaggerating, it was not 2 weeks, but for about a week, it was just that, right? It was kind of boring, but in a way it wasn't because you're outside in the sun, the leaves of the trees, it's kind of pretty, you know, doing the movements. It was fun. And, of course, my friends being very impressed, that helped my ego to keep doing it and pretend I'm actually debating. So it was, right? I mean, so that's how we learned it. So that's why with the movements, that's why we learned the movements first, and then we had to actually start using the language by taking any kind of topic. And that was an extra, I don't know, a month or whatever, however long it took. Yeah. Anyway, so 4 hours every day, that's a long time. Yeah. Okay. So that's just the story of how you, so I'm not exactly encouraging this because it's very confusing doing both. But yes, you just now had already a debate kind of going here. And it was not like two presidential candidates, kind of like one talking about the war in Iraq and the other one talking about something else, and, you know, one cracks a better joke and the other one. It's not about that. You really need to stay with the topic. You can't get away, you know, talking about instruction and about the Dharma and bring something else in, because we have a topic here. We have a subject. Is the instruction of not how to debate, that's our subject, is that a teaching? Is that instruction of how to, sorry, the instruction of how not to practice the Dharma, is that an instruction of to practice the Dharma or not? There's no way to escape and talk about elephants, right? So this is how, this shows you how it keeps it focused on a certain topic. Because you keep the language very simple. It's like A is B is equal to C. And there's no logical inconsistency, because you can take anything and can check it, is whatever this, not necessarily this. And, yeah. Another thing that you learn very effectively, because sometimes we have a problem between differentiating having and being, right? I have a female body, but I am not a female body. I have a female body, therefore I am a woman, but I do not have a woman, right? This is very important. This idea, I am a human being, right? And there's a sense of an I that's separate from mind and body. That's why I say I have a body, I have a mind, but I'm not a body and I'm not a mind. And sometimes I identify so strongly with my body, right? People identify very strongly with their body. That's a problem, depending on the body. You know, but if you're not happy with your body and identify strongly with your body, you're in trouble, right? You may develop an eating disorder, right, because of that. Or you identify very strongly with your mind and you start hating yourself. You're not your mind. You're not your body. We have a mind. We have a body. Okay. But also this idea of like being or having, is there a separate I or not? Right? Is there actually a separate I, a real I, the way it feels it? It feels to be a separate I, right? So this is this whole discussion. I mean, I could go more into it, and that's a different topic of like the self, the I. But you can see there's a difference. It's important to differentiate I am and I have. So we do that all the time in the debate too. The white horse, like going back to the white horse. Well, if it's not white, how come it's a white horse? It has the color white. The color of a white horse is white. I mean, we don't need to change the language and make things so complicated when we talk in everyday life. So, you know, Tibetans still say, even monks and nuns who have done the study, they still say the white horse is white. So no worries about that. But precisely speaking, right, so in the debate context, language has to be used very precisely, because if language is the only thing that gets us closer to the truth, and even though language, of course, is limited, we need to make sure we use it in a consistent way, Consistency is important. Either we say use it this way or another way, but let's be consistent, because otherwise we're in trouble. Does that still make sense? So, you get a sense of what we're talking about here. So, going back to the idea of how can you actually use this, and I want to bring this back to using these kind of logical arguments, and what you learn now, it's already a lot. You've learned already a lot about seeing the relationship between phenomena. And I love this example. Like, yes, an instruction of teaching, or a Veda Dharma teaching as an instruction of practice. Wonderful to do this. Yeah? And it gives you a better understanding. Just thinking about it, what does it mean to be a teaching? What does it mean to be an instruction? And if you do it with more than just one person, you have the benefit. And sometimes you may just kind of call someone up, right? Where we are busy, maybe you can't meet, but just what do you think? And then over the phone, you could have a discussion. And two minds are always better than one mind. There's always like some extra that the other person can offer you. Yes, please.
I have a question regarding the teaching of regarding sentient beings.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people view plants as sentient beings.
Mm-hmm.
And others don't.
Ah.
And we don't. So how can I debate that with somebody that view plants as sentient beings?
Okay. How could you prove? All right. I think your question is basically, all right, if someone disagrees that sentient being that plants are sentient beings. No, thinks that they're sentient beings. But I'm a Buddhist and I think that, okay. Actually, I don't know whether they're sentient beings or not. I know it says that in the scriptures, but I'm not necessarily sure. I'm not necessarily sure that they're not sentient beings. And even His Holiness the Dalai Lama has been asked once about, like, I remember I saw a book where His Holiness was asked, are plants sentient beings? And His Holiness said, well, and the scriptures seem to be saying no. But His Holiness was saying, but this plant in the corner, and I guess he was in a room where there was a plant in the corner, I don't know whether it's a living being or not. So actually, I think there are certain points that it's fun to discuss them, but in the end, they're not that important. I think it's great that you're asking this, and you could debate it. I debated it with, initially I was like, oh right, it says in the scriptures they're not sentient beings, so that's what I will agree. Right? Do you have something to say there? Please.
I wanted to make a point on this particular issue.
Sure.
Specifically, they are, in the scriptures, said to be not sentient beings because they do not have mind.
Okay, great.
Now, we have mind both at the gross level and at many, many, many more subtle levels. Therefore, we say that plants are not sentient beings because they do not have mind.
Wonderful, wonderful. Go on.
I have a further point to make on that.
A question
on that. As we come to know how things live at more and more precise and subtle levels, could we not say that a plant's response to the sun or a plant's turning and dancing in light shows that there is some sensitivity that borders on a kind of mind, or the fact that they respond to music? And how you argue to somebody, because that's what people say, it is or is not sentient on the basis of these facts.
Great. Actually, the first thing that you said, I was like, great, I can debate with you now. But then you almost turned around kind of saying, well, they could have, right? Yes, what you said before was like, absolutely, in the scriptures it says they do not have a mind because they do not have feeling. There's also this idea of like, there's no feeling. They don't have a feeling. All right. So, but how do we know? It says in the scriptures, but as the Buddha says, do not believe anything I tell you. So what would be, and certain things, you see, this is something very important to understand. You cannot establish everything with logic. In a sense, you can establish a lot, but then, you see, let me give you an example. If I'm blind, okay, let's say I'm blind since birth, you could argue the color blue exists. You can bring the best arguments, but it will be very difficult. I will generate a strong conviction that the color blue exists. But until I generate a mind, that is, in other words, generate an eye consciousness, fix the eye and generate an eye consciousness to be able to perceive it, it will only be a conviction until that day. So the same is true for certain things such as knowing another being has a mind or not. One has to have clairvoyance. I can use a lot of reasoning. I can know I have a mind myself. And I can basically, knowing my own mind, I can kind of infer to some degree, but not incontrovertibly realize that you have a mind. I believe this 100%. And we use the word I know, I realize, very, very loosely. What day were you born? Just tell me the day of your, what day? Yes, please. Which day of the... Do you know that?
Yes. 100%?
Are you 100% sure, incontrovertibly? Do you realize that? 100%. Okay, but they could have made a mistake. They could have made a mistake. They could have gotten it wrong that day. Okay, great, great, great. Great, there you go. So do you still know?
My mother says I could not forget the day my first child was born. It was Friday, November 29th. But Friday, November 29th
was a Saturday.
The day Israel became a nation.
So to be honest, you don't know 100% you were born on that day, right?
That is true.
Okay, wonderful. That's all I need to know. So therefore, we use the word to know too loosely. I know golf is good for me because I Googled it and some PhD guy said so. I mean, we say we know, but actually to know means to know incontrovertibly. No matter what someone comes and tells you, you will not be swayed. So therefore, to know that another person has a mind, I can believe this and I can be so convinced. I'm convinced you have a mind. I'm 100% convinced. Have I realized? No. When will I know? When I, through meditation, generate a mind that's called clairvoyance, where I can perceive your mind directly. Just as a blind person cannot perceive blue, unless they have that mind. If they have generated the mind, which is the eye consciousness perceiving blue, then I don't need reasoning to establish it. But in the meantime, so right now our minds are very limited. So certain things through debate, we can come to a strong conviction. We generate faith based on reasoning. But it's still faith. And scientific things, we say we know, it's based on faith. And I haven't realized that the globe is round. Sorry, I have not sat down to do all the reasoning. I totally believe it. I have 100% faith, but I have not incontrovertibly come to realize it. And if some PhD guy who's, I don't know, just as good as Albert Einstein or someone else tells me now it's oval, is that the kind? Right, then I'd be the first one to say, all right, they've just proven that. If I had taken that space to the spacecraft to the moon, and, you know, I've seen it myself, and if I've done all the reasoning, there's nothing this person, however impressive their PhD is, could prove to me. But I haven't. I just believe it. I just trust it. So this is the point. Dharma practice doesn't mean you understand everything incontrovertibly. You can still move on, gaining a correct assumption about it. Right? And then you need to take it deeper. You cannot just stay there. You need to get an incontrovertible knowledge of that. It's not sufficient. So there are many steps there. So the idea of plans having a mind or not, a clairvoyant person who is through meditation, through incredible intense practices, they could say so. So that's why we would say, oh, right, I assume the Buddha had clairvoyance, even more so, being omniscient, and the Buddha had no reason to lie to us about that. I mean, why would you say, so I can assume they don't, but I won't have 100% knowledge of that. And it's like trying to, like, your question, how can I prove to a person, it's like trying to prove to a blind person that there's blue. I mean, I'm blind, and they are blind, and I'm trying to prove there's blue. Come on, right? So we both don't really know. And certain things, I think they're not that important for the time being. My favorite example is when His Holiness the Dalai Lama was asked during one of the teachings he gave at the TCV school. He teaches the TCV students every year. So one of the TCV students came up with this question, which we debate frequently, but then we let it go. We never come to some conclusion. What happens if everyone is enlightened? Right? What happens, right, yeah, what happens then, right? What happens, like, you know, you're the last person left? For the benefit of all sentient beings? Well, there are no sentient beings left. You never get there because there's no sentient beings. So there are all these bizarre kind of, and it's always like, oh my God. And the Taoist gave a response. It sounds a little unkind, so don't take it personal. Because no, it was a little unkind. I mean, it sounds unkind, but typical Tibetan, it wasn't unkind, and it was so to the point. He said, there was this girl, she got up in front of His Holiness. She's like, oh, Your Holiness, what happens when everyone is enlightened? Are the Buddhas unemployed or something? She didn't say that, but you know, what is going to happen? They can't work for the benefit of sentient beings. There's no one left. And and His Holiness said, don't mind the business of something that's not your business. It's kind of like, who cares then? Just work towards enlightenment. Do what, right?
It's going to be a party.
Right? We could just party. Yeah, then we can party and just not worry about it. Then it doesn't matter anymore. But it's like sometimes it's the same idea. You know, with the arrow? Have you heard the story of the arrow? Sometimes we investigate things for too much, right? We get into things that are really not that important. And I'm not saying this is not an important question. This is an important question. But I'm just saying sometimes maybe it's not necessary to spend too much time, because there's this example where the Buddha was asked, well, where does this come from? Why? When did this start? When did we get into there? When did ignorance start? Da, 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 da. And he's like, right, you know, it's like you're shot by an arrow, right? Someone shoots you in the arrow, an arrow with you. And instead of trying to pull it out, we're asking, who shot the arrow? What was his name? How many sisters and brothers does he have? Where did he buy the arrow, right? It's like, come on, take out the arrow. So to actually focus on that which is most important. But his question is nonetheless important. So to have to prove that there is life or not is not really what we need to, but we can still discuss it. And in a way, I would like people to think plants have life, because otherwise you're a murderer when you cut down trees and so forth. So in the end, you know, I mean, if they're sentient, actually, I think it would be better to look after the environment. So in that way, I don't necessarily want people to, yeah. So there could actually be a benefit to think that they are. But does a tree meditate? Is a tree reborn? I don't know. Right? But good question, good question. Sorry, I'm too long-winded. I don't want to be that. But just to get a sense of, yeah. Please, go ahead.
I'm just going to debate.
No. You're going to debate. That's great. Can you debate?
No, I was just going to debate the plant thing.
Oh. But you can still debate the plant, just for the sake of doing it. Sorry.
Go for it.
Go for it.
Okay, so if we talk about the idea of debate, and you said the first thing we have to discuss is the definition of things.
So then,
our first definition would be, what is
a sentient being?
What is mind? And we can't define mind, therefore we couldn't come to a conclusion. Because
can we not define mind?
How can we define a mind of a plant, though? Because we are not plants, so therefore we wouldn't be able to define it.
Oh, wait. But we can define mind.
That which has a feeling. That which
what is clear and knowing.
But a plant?
Okay, so this goes into the philosophical discussion. I don't know if you know of Talos, that every thing has a thing that it does exactly the way it's supposed to, like a hawk. A hawk flies in the air, and it has reached its Talos, its destiny, basically, what it's supposed to do,
right.
And it does it well. So a plant, it grows. It photosynthesizes.
But I'm just the same, right? I do what I know, I do as well. I eat, you know, I go to the toilet, I do that very well. So I would be like a hawk and like a plant. Do I have a mind or not? I could argue.
But then you could argue that yes, a plant has a mind because it has its own mind.
Okay.
It might not be the same quality as my mind.
That's right, but your mind is not the same quality as my mind.
Exactly.
So but that doesn't mean I'm not a sentient being just because my mind is not like your mind.
Mind is mind.
And how do we define sentient being? How do we define sentient being, by the way? Is the Buddha a sentient being?
No.
He has a consciousness. Very good. Okay, so I'm just kidding here. I'm just tricking you here. I mean, that's just showing you how to debate. What did I do? And that's why I wanted to hear your argument, right? And we can pass it on after that. But I just wanted to hear your argument. This is great. This is an example, right? You're right in that way, of course, but your argument, you're right in that sense, like, how can we tell and so forth, but your argument I would see some fold in it, and I go back at it and throw it back at you by saying, okay, if you say the mind of a flower is different to my mind, and therefore I cannot say it's sentient being, well, then I can say, you know, your mind is different from my mind. Does that follow? I'm not a sentient being, right? But in the end, we have to define what it means to be a sentient being. To be a sentient being, in Tibetan, the word means that which has mind, but that is just the name. To be a sentient being just means something that has a mind and it is not enlightened. That is the definition, if you like, or the meaning of being. So, sentient beings and Buddhas are not the same. Right. But let's just assume a plant and so forth. Again, a mind is defined as that which is clear in the sense that things can appear to it and it is knowing and it can experience things. But I don't know whether you have such an entity. I only know I have that myself. And even that, I'm not, you know, I mean, oh God, I mean, I say I know, actually, honestly, I'm lying here. I assume I do, right? But through meditation, you can come to that comprehension. But, you see, why are we doing this? Eventually, we need to come to an incontrovertible understanding of that, where we don't even need to understand words. But it takes us in the right direction. It takes us in the direction where to look, and then generate the understand or the mind, a deeper mind that allows us to perceive others' minds the way we perceive blue right now. Right? And in the meantime, let's leave it open. Doubt is good. That kind of doubt is not harmful. Are they sentient or not? Let's assume there are. It's a win-win situation. We'll cut down a few trees. Okay, next question then. I think there was, yeah.
Jackie, did you start? Oh, Wendy.
On a practical level,
mm-hmm.
seems like there may be an underlying purpose here to deconstruct some of our own false assumptions about things that we have going on out there. That even so, you know, maybe whether something's sentient or not is beyond the scope of what I would think about. But what do I dislike about my neighbor? Let's say, you know, or something.
Mm-hmm.
I go through life making all these.
Mm-hmm.
false assumptions,
mm-hmm.
and if I begin to question those, I can kind of deconstruct that a little bit.
That's something very important he just said, and I didn't say that, but that's why I love these questions in between. And I don't want to really start with question answers yet, but I'm glad you're bringing up things so I can respond to that and give you an explanation that is very, very important, which is exactly what you were just saying, that this is what we think things through. Oh my God, that was hard to say. We think that we always think things through. But we're not always consistent. There's a lot of contradictions in, yes, absolutely. The white horse is white is kind of a good idea, a good example, right? Like there's some inconsistencies in how we think and so forth. So this is a great way of breaking that apart. To kind of go back again and think, how would I define such and such? If I define such and such, does that make sense? Am I consistent with my, okay, if that's a sentient being, just as valuable as myself, just as important as myself, important for my enlightened one, why I think the person's such a jerk and really want to, you know, do anything that harms that person, right? Yeah? And it's like one day I think this way and the next way I think differently. It's the same way our relationships with other people, like even the relationship with the people we're closest to. I love that person, but I say things to them I would never say to the guy on the market who sells me the bananas. Like, no way. I would never say these hurtful things. So here's the person I say I love, but I try to hurt the most, right? So there's all these inconsistencies. So to learn and really be more analytical with our own behavior, that's also part of this. And to become aware of those inconsistencies, many of our wrong views, we're not even conscious of them. They're subconsciously, and that's scary. There's a mind that almost seems subconsciously there and still controlling us. The misperception of how we exist. That's most important. What is the I? Right? I mean, there's such inconsistency. There's a sense I'm separate from mind and body at times, right? My mind, my body. I hate my mind. I hate my hair. I hate my body. Da da, right? And then again, I'm fat, or I have pimples. I'm a bad person, Because I mean, it's like the same as my body, right? I am forgetful. I'm a bad person. As if there was nothing else but the forgetfulness. So we're totally to think, like, the way we think of ourselves, and that's most important, actually. It starts from there. Who am I? How do I really exist? Because the sense of I, me, and mine, that's what controls us in everyday life. So to check, really, that's why I love to do the reasonings. And there's a wonderful book by Thomas the Dalai Lama. It's called How to See Yourself as You Really Are. People don't really understand, I mean, don't really know. It's not advertised enough, may I guess. This is one of the most profound books with the greatest reasonings regarding the I. There are very deep reasonings here. How to See Yourself as You Really Are. It's such a profound book, actually. And it's just, in India, it's sold in that there's a cheaper version of it. People don't buy it because it's cheaper. It's just our bizarre way of like, oh, it's more expensive. It must be a better book, right? Anyway, so that's just in India. But like around here, I mean, I'm sure the book is available. It has such great reasoning, and it allows us to do exactly what he was just saying. Also, to become aware of these weird ways of thinking of how I exist and other phenomena exist. So that's something very important. Again, this debate technique, it allows us to do that. So, am I consistent? Is whatever it is necessarily that? Is whatever that? If I really exist that way, if I'm really one with my body, okay, is whatever I am my body?